You know, if you asked me in February or March, I think we were disappointed that we didn't see much demand for, you know, for World Cup itineraries. And that changed about 6 weeks ago. It was like a switch went off.
What happens when the world's biggest sporting event collides with one of the fastest growing sectors in transportation? Today we're joined by Barry Shevlin, CEO of Fly USA, to take us behind the scenes of private aviation during the FIFA World Cup. From the surge in international travel to the logistics of moving high-profile clients, Barry offers a unique perspective on an industry most people never see. In this conversation, Barry shares lessons from scaling businesses, the realities behind private air travel, and how the World Cup is reshaping travel demand. This is Barry Innovators, and I'm your host, Steve Ispas. Barry, welcome to Bay Area Innovators.
Oh, thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, great to have you here, especially since you're in Ireland, so we have a bit of a time difference, but glad to have you here. So you are the CEO of Fly USA, that's the leading company, the fastest growing aviation company right now in the US. And we'll talk about your company in a little bit, but I want to start with Vology. Vology is the company that you started, you grew it from a startup to $175 million company. Please tell us a bit about Vology, and after that, why did you make the change from this IT services company to an aviation company?
Yeah. So yeah, prior to starting Fly USA, I spent most of my adult life running technology companies, and Vology was, you know, my longest tenured and you know, largest company that I built. My wife and I actually founded that business in our garage in 2002. You know, if you think about what was happening in 2002, the dot-com bubble had just burst. You know, the telecom recession was underway. There was a general recession at the same time. 9/11 had just happened. It was a tough time, a lot of disruption, and we saw an opportunity where we actually started buying and selling pre-owned networking equipment. And that's how we started the business. And it was a great growth story. We did $1 million that first year in 2002. We did $4 million the second, and $7 million the third, and $10 million the fourth, and $17 million the fifth, and $40 million the sixth. You know, and that got us to 2007, you know, before the Great Recession happened. And then, you know, when that happened, the industry, the IT industry as a whole, you know, contracted by 20 or 25%, depending whose report you want to rely on. And we actually grew 13 or 14% through those years. So we were very resilient in the way we, you know, continued to grow the business. Got it to about $80 million in top line revenue 10 years in. And in that first decade, it was, you know, we really didn't have any institutional capital. It was primarily bootstrapped for the first few years. We had a few investors along the way, but our first institutional capital raise was in 2011, about 10 years in. At that point, you know, our business was primarily selling IT hardware, mostly data center equipment, so switches, routers, firewalls, and the like, VoIP phone systems, VoIP phones, that was the extent of it. So what we like to say is we weren't selling anything you typically find in somebody's house. You know, it was stuff that was going into data centers. But we saw that the way our customers were consuming technology was changing a bit. And at that point in 2011, we decided that we wanted to grow our services business. So as opposed to just being a hardware reseller, becoming a more true service provider, where we could not just sell the equipment to our clients, but monitor them, support them, manage them on their behalf. So I think we raised $32 or $35 million in that first raise in 2011. And then we acquired five companies over the next 6 years.
Wow.
And ultimately grew the business, as you mentioned, to about $175 million in top-line revenue. In 2017, we divested that original business that sold the pre-owned equipment. And then 2 years later, you know, sold the rest of the business to a private equity group.
Where did you start the company? Where was the garage? What city?
It was in Palm Harbor, Florida.
So it was basically the Tampa Bay area. Okay.
Is where we were based. Our offices were in Oldsmar initially. Was the name of the city. It was funny, the way the business was growing, we moved every single year for the first 5 years we were in business, because we were constantly moving into slightly larger warehouses to support the business. I was very risk averse, so I didn't want to sign a lease for more space than we really needed. But it meant that every Christmas, instead of being, doing Christmas stuff, we were moving equipment from one warehouse to another, because that was the logical time to move stuff when things were slow. So
that's very smart. That's a smart way to do it. That's great. So you're in the other Bay Area. You were not in the Silicon Valley, but
exactly, the other Bay Area. That's right. And you asked about how that transition to FlyUSA. In 2012 or 2013, I was traveling a lot at Volgy, and we had customers in a lot of weird places or rural areas that were difficult to get to with commercial aviation. And I like to use Gulfport, Mississippi as an example. We were based in Tampa. We had a large customer in Gulfport, Mississippi. To get to Gulfport by commercial travel, you had two options. We could fly to Delta to Atlanta, and then they had one flight a day to Gulfport, or you would fly to New Orleans and then drive an hour and a half or 2 hours to get there. So it was nothing that you could ever do in one day. It was always a two-day trip, kind of at a minimum. So I had a couple of friends that were buying a plane, and they asked me if I wanted to buy a third of the plane that they were acquiring. And, I looked into the economics, and I'm not sure it made total financial sense, but, from a lifestyle perspective, I wanted to spend, more nights at home, sleep in my own bed, spend time with my family, because that's time you don't get back. And so in my mind, I was, justified the investment to me. And that was my introduction to private aviation. My partners and I owned that plane for 3 years, and it was a great experience. And learned a lot along the way as a first time aircraft owner then. But
did you fly it?
Did
you fly it, or you had to have a pilot that flies?
We had a pilot. We had a management company. We had a gentleman by the name of Nick Barrows who owned a company called 3B Aviation. He managed the plane for us, managed all the maintenance. He flew the plane. He was our primary pilot. And he provided a white glove turnkey service for us. And the one thing we were doing a little differently that we were doing back then that I wouldn't do today is we were flying that plane single pilot. So even though it was a jet and with 8 seats in the back, it was Nick was normally our pilot. And when Nick wasn't available, there was another pilot that would fill in. His name was Bill, but his nickname was Old Bill. And one flight to the Bahamas, my wife Kathy was saying, "Barry, I'm a little nervous. Bill's a little older. I said, what if something happens to Bill?" And I said, "That's an interesting question, Kath." I said, "That would be a problem." She was referring to it with a medical event. So I asked her. I said, "Would you feel better if I learned how to fly?" She said, as a matter of fact, she would. So I never asked a second time, and 4 months later, I had a pilot's license and then started flying myself. I never flew that plane, but we bought a Cirrus. SR-22 was the first plane that we bought. I flew that for a few years, and then I upgraded to a Piper Meridian, which is a turboprop, and that was just a fantastic plane, one of the favorite planes I've ever owned. And that is really when it went from being a business tool to being, more of a passion. Think about it. I was a CEO of a pretty visible technology company. I was in the FAA database as a plane owner, and I was in the FAA database as a pilot. So when you put those three things together, I was on everybody's lead list. So, I would constantly hear from NetJets and FlexJet to sell me a fractional, the jet card providers to sell me jet cards. And in the back of my mind, Steve, I was always like, this industry is just, everyone seems to have the same go-to-market approach, same marketing strategy, and I just felt like it was something that in the back of my mind, I thought it was something I could do better. So in 2020, right when the COVID hit, my son-in-law and I told him, I said, "I've been thinking about this for a while. I've got this idea." I said, "What do you think? Would you have any interest in working with me on testing my theory that I could build a better, more cost-effective customer acquisition machine for private aviation customers?" And I got to know him as when I was flying. My daughter was a student at UF. William was stationed in the Coast Guard in Savannah, Georgia. And, you know, I had the opportunity to, it seemed like every other weekend I was flying one or the other back and forth to see each other. And that was a great time of, you know, my life to be able to spend that type of time, quality time with the family. But it also was when William started catching the aviation bug as well. So he was excited for us to try this. We stuck our toe in the water in 2020 and started what became Fly USA, and, you know, certainly proud of what it's become today.
Yeah, and again, as I mentioned, it seems like it's the fastest growing aviation company. Now, what would you say you learned from Vology that helped you in building this new company? Were a lot of the concepts the same, like acquiring customers, concepts or leads or customers?
Yeah, the two pieces that translated very well. One was just lead generation. A lot of the growth at Vology was a result of the fact that I'm an expert in digital marketing and search engine optimization. In Vology's early days, you know, we built a very large web presence where we were attracting 3,000-4,000 people a day coming to our, you know, network of websites looking to buy, sell, or research equipment. And then we built some technology that enabled us to blindly identify the people that were on our website. And, you know, if somebody from a Tampa General Hospital was on our website looking at a part, it would come into our system and it would say, hey, they didn't have to fill out a form or anything else. We would blindly identify that it was someone from, you know, Tampa General. We would route that lead to one of our salespeople who would then, you know, follow up with them very, very quickly. So, you know, so from a lead generation standpoint, theories that we use to build the traffic flow and lead flow at Vology is exactly what we did at Fly USA to accelerate the growth here. The second piece was the Salesforce structure and optimization. I think the customers in the IT world were, you know, until we bought those services companies, there was no real recurring revenue. They were customers that bought when they needed something, they would call us and buy it. We refer to that as reoccurring revenue. You need to earn your customer's business with every transaction, because the most important deal is the next deal. So make sure we take care of our customers on this one. And, you know, we take that same philosophy and translate it to Fly USA. The customers work the same way. They pay for one trip. We need to, you know, deliver a consistent luxury experience. And the next time they need a trip, we want to make sure that we're staying in front of them and they're calling us. So the way we manage the account bases, the way we manage the sales team, all very, very similar and translated, you know, pretty well over. The other similarities, you know, in the years at Vology, we always had a process in place where we would spend, you know, a good amount of time on strategy. And we used at that company, we used a framework that was developed by a gentleman by the name of Keith McFarland, who wrote a book called Breakthrough Companies, and it was called RED, or Rapid Enterprise Development. And, you know, that framework was that the executive team and all managers would go off site for a couple days to plan the year annually, follow up with quarterly meetings quarterly to make sure that the quarterly objectives were aligning with the annual goals. And it was just good rigor and helped with alignment and communication and focus. And, here at Fly USA, we're using something very similar, but designed for smaller companies called EOS. It was based on a book called Traction, written by a gentleman by the name of Gino Wickman. And, you know, we use that as our operating system here. And, you know, those philosophies were very similar to Keith McFarland's RED process. And, we all attribute, having that rigor and cadence and structure as part of the key to our success as an organization.
Now, give us a bit of a sense how private aviation actually works. So with a commercial flight, you buy a ticket online or whatever, you go to the airport, you go through security, you check in, and then you fly. I assume you have to rent the whole plane, right?
Correct. Our business model is whole plane charter. There are some other companies that sell private charter by the seat. That is not part of our offering today. Like most other private aviation businesses, when our customers are coming to us, they are either buying or renting an entire plane.
And that's how many seats? It's 8 to 10, you said, or?
Yeah, it can vary. Most of the planes that we operate, manage, have between 8 and 10 seats. That's correct. I mean, some of the longer range planes have 12 or 14, but I'd say 90% of the flights that we operate are 8 or 10 seat planes.
So if a customer calls you, you're basically offering the service of with a pilot and everything. So they just have to show up at the airport and...
Yeah, we have a couple lines of business. And the first one and where we acquire our clients is exactly that. It's, we refer to that as our on-demand charter business. So, if you call us and you need a flight from San Francisco to New York, you would typically either find us, Philip, on the website and price the flight there, or come to, you could download our app and do the same thing. In either case, that gets routed to one of our aviation advisors, and they will get back to you in a matter of minutes with a couple of options, normally some clarifying questions. Are you taking golf bags? It is a special occasion. Any special needs? And then when we're able to, very quickly, send a couple options to that client. That velocity piece is very important to us. We believe in being responsive. So when a new potential customer is coming to us, we want to get back to them in a matter of minutes. Existing customers, when they need something, same thing. So I think it's that responsiveness is really deeply ingrained in our DNA.
How many planes do you have now?
We manage approximately 30 planes in our fleet, but we've got access to a couple thousand others from vetted operators that we partner with around the U.S., well, actually around the world.
Okay. So how do people get on? Do they have to go through the regular security that you go through, or is there like a separate
part? No. Good question. Yeah. No, there's every airport has what are called FBOs. It stands for Fixed Base Operator, which is basically, you can think of it as a private airline terminal, and that's where the private, private flights go. Nice thing is, we vet our clients through TSA electronically, so you don't have to go through the long TSA lines. You go to the FBO. You only need to be there 15 minutes before your flight takes off. When you get to the FBO, either the pilots or one of our employees or a cabin attendant will meet and greet the passengers, take their luggage, put them on the plane, see if anyone has any need, any special needs or requests, and then, escort them to the plane and off they go.
Do they still go through the metal detectors and all those scanners and security?
Not typically, no.
No, okay. What has been your experience with the World Cup and the demand in aviation with the World Cup? It's in full swing right now, and there's a lot of people traveling, a huge amount of people traveling. What have you seen?
It is. It's been a nice tailwind for us. It's funny, three or four months ago, we were expecting to see, the demand. We thought people would be planning pretty far in advance. And I would say that, if you asked me in February or March, I think we were disappointed that we didn't see much demand for World Cup itineraries. And that changed about 6 weeks ago. It was like a switch went off, and we started seeing an awful lot of requests. And it's going to be really nice. It's going to be a really great month for us. We're actually going to have our best month ever this month in June, and we certainly attribute that to some of the lift that we're seeing from the World Cup. It's a couple of interesting things. Like we're a U.S.-based company. Obviously, our name's FlyUSA. Our clients are predominantly U.S. domiciled clients. We do help them normally with travel worldwide. So as if our U.S.-based customers are in Europe, we take care of their travel needs there as well. That's no problem. What's different about this event is we're finding a lot of folks that are coming here from Europe and South and Central America, for the World Cup. And there's a couple of neat things about it. A is that we now, over half of our business for the World Cup is for international clients as opposed to domestic clients, and they're staying. I mean, they're not coming for a game. It seems like they're going to be here for a few weeks, until their team is out, and that's kind of cool.
Who are some of your clients? Can you give us some examples, be it World Cup travelers or others? Clearly, this is seen by most as a luxury way of travel. Give us some examples of who your clients are.
I mean, our typical client profile is ultra high net worth individuals that have probably grown a business. A lot of what you refer to as baby boomers have grown a business. Many of them have sold a business, maybe sold a couple of businesses, and you know, and this is, you know, this is now, you know, part of the way they want to travel. They feel like they've earned it and they deserve it, and they want control of their time and control of their schedule. You know, so I know everyone thinks it's a, you know, it's a luxury product, and it's about luxury. And I really think our client base is more about time. They want control of their time and they want control of their schedule, as opposed to being beholden to the airline schedules. If they have a meeting in Gulfport, Mississippi, and it ends 2 hours early, they can go home 2 hours early. You know, and you know, that flexibility and control is really important to our client base. The World Cup customers, you know, I mean, we definitely have. It seems like a lot of them are in, you know, fit that profile internationally, but I think we have a lot of people in financial services, so hedge funds, private equity groups, family offices that from overseas. It seems like that profile is indicative of you know, who we're seeing coming and, you know, staying for a few weeks or a month for the, you know, for the World Cup.
Now, I'm sure you can't give us specific names, but for the World Cup, what are most countries represented that you've seen customers flying with you?
England, Spain, Brazil, Bolivia. Those are, you know, those probably come to mind. Germany, and Germany as well.
Yeah, the usual suspects. Well, you know, just a few days ago, I went to I did an episode for my other channel, and you can see it in the description below here. At the World Cup game in San Francisco, in Santa Clara actually, at Levi Stadium. And I talked to a lot of the people coming out of the game. And this was Qatar versus Switzerland. It was 1-1, you know, it was an interesting game. But what I found fascinating is that every single person I talked to were not from here. They were all traveling from somewhere else.
Yeah.
And both the Qatar and the Swiss people, they were going to all the games. So they came to San Francisco, they're going to Vancouver, and they're going to Los Angeles overnight. So they're all traveling to every single game their team goes to. So that fold, is that what you're seeing as well?
Yeah, that's consistent with what we're seeing.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, especially for some countries, it's their first time that they make it to the World Cup, or one of the few times, so it's a big thing. Now, how do you deal with international flights? Do these planes, the 8 to 10 seater planes, can these go over the ocean? Are they big enough?
Yeah, they can. The you know, the 10 seat plane that we standardize on is the Falcon 2000. You know, we've got a number of those in our fleet. The newer versions of those are, you know, they have a 4,000 mile range, so they can make it from you know, from Tampa to the UK nonstop. So, you know, a lot of times people will go up one larger to a long range or ultra long range plane, and we have access to a number of those for our partners as well. So,
now give us a sense of what it costs. For example, New York to San Francisco or San Francisco to LA. What would be the cost to rent
New York to San Francisco, you'd need to go nonstop, which we always recommend. You'd need a super mid-sized jet, and that's about probably a $40,000 flight. You know, San Francisco to LA is about, what is it, a 2-hour flight? So that would be a little less than half that, maybe 18 or 20,000, and you have some more economical options. I'm using the word economical, relatively speaking, but you know, if they want to take a light jet instead of a mid-size, you can maybe do that for 15,000.
But again, that's for up to 10 people, right?
If they're going down to the light jet, it'd be, you know, 6 comfortably, 7 or 8 potentially, yeah.
What would happen if someone owns a plane? What would that cost be if you own your own plane? I'm assuming there's a lot of other, you know, overhead costs that you would have to pay.
Yeah, it's the plane owners look at it differently. I mean, the first cost is obviously the acquisition price of the plane, and that's just the beginning. You know, planes are not cheap, and if they are cheap, they're cheap for a reason, and that's typically not good. But you know, so you have the acquisition cost of the plane, and most people that are buying planes are taking advantage of you know, right now there's bonus depreciation available, so there's some tax benefits that are available to folks that are going to use the plane for business purposes. The next thing you have are your monthly fixed costs, and that would include your hangar rent, your insurance, any of your subscriptions for your navigation, for your internet, and your detailing. You know, those become a monthly fixed cost, and then there's a variable hourly rate, which is the cost of your fuel, your engine programs, and the FBO fees. So using those same two examples, you know, the variable costs to go from New York to San Francisco would probably be $18,000 or $20,000 for a, you know, super mid-sized jet, and to go from from San Francisco to LA be half that.
So you have to fly a lot to make it worth it, of course, your own plane.
Yeah, we normally tell people if they're not flying 125 or 150 hours a year, it probably doesn't make sense for them to buy a whole plane. But what a lot of people do, you know, I'm assuming you're familiar with NetJets, is, you know, a fractional model where you can buy a slice of a plane. And, you know, clients like that because it's predictable cost. They still have a sense of ownership. And, you know, it's a neat product that's, you know, been around for about 30 years that's been well received by the charter community.
What would you say you're doing different that makes your company the fastest growing aviation company for 2 years in a row, that is, 24 and 25?
Yeah. I think, you know, our differentiators, it goes to, you know, responsiveness, which we talked about earlier, and just being hyper responsive to our clients' needs, personalized. We really get to know our clients and want to make sure that we know, you know, the clients' names, their spouses' names, their children's names, their pets' names, if the pets come, what they like to eat and drink, and make sure that's on the plane when they're flying with us. You know, they have a, you know, it's a very, boutique personal feel with us, because they have their advisor that is, you know, kind of their Sherpa that guides them through the process, and is there for, they're always just a text message away. Clients don't feel like they're a number. They know that it's a very personalized experience with us. And then last, we just want to make it easy. You know, there's a lot of friction in the business, a lot of paperwork, a lot of things. We do a lot of work around trying to make it as easy as possible for our clients to do business with us. So, you know, internally, we really focus on those three things as our three differentiators as a business: responsive, personalized, and easy.
Can you talk about some of the difficulties that you've been through with your companies and how you came out of it? I think you had a story earlier that stood out.
Oh, that was Advology. Sure. Yeah, that was that was an interesting time. While that was a great growth story, in 2007, we had just gone from, you know, 17 million revenue in 06 to 40 million in 07. And as we entered 2008, some of our infrastructure broke, and we realized that, you know, we needed to rebuild, you know, certain things. We went very quickly from doing $1 million a month in revenue to $4 million a month, and just a lot of our systems and processes broke. Initially we kind of threw people at the problem instead of process. And then, you know, in early 2008, we realized that we were overstaffed. So for the first time in our, you know, in our history at that point, we had to let some people go. And so it was the first time that we did a layoff, if you would. So that day, I think it was March 8th or 9th, 2008, I started having a town hall meeting with our employees. Every employee was invited to it. It was at 11:30 every day for clients that weren't at our headquarters. We video conferenced them in. And every single day we would talk about how the company did the day before, you know, what our goals were for that day, how are we tracking for the month, maybe the quarter and the year as well, but just, and then any anecdotes of any important things that we wanted to share with the team. And I just felt it was important for me as the CEO to be present and in front of all the customers. You know, there was a crazy time then that, you know, the Great Recession was happening, you had these big banks failing. There was a lot of anxiety is the word I'm looking for. There was a lot of anxiety. So I felt like if I could get in front of everybody, be as transparent as possible with our numbers, our goals, what we're doing, that would help relieve the anxiety. You know, and the message was basically, look, yeah, there's a recession, but the sky's not falling. You know, we're going to get through this. You know, I'd prefer that we don't participate in the recession. And people laughed at that, but it was, you know, in the end, you know, again, we grew in 2008 and 2009 when very, very few people did that. So, you know, as I look back at my career, those are two pretty exceptional years from an execution standpoint. And I attribute a lot of that to, it was, you know, I hunkered down and made sure I was in front of all the employees every day. And by the way, I did that for like a decade. So it was, you know, every day, the, you know, 11:30, have these meetings. They only last 5 or 10 minutes. You know, they weren't terribly long, but it was, you know, it was impactful. And, you know, I think people that I run into that I used to work with back then, they still talk about those, you know, the fact that we had those meetings every single day. So it certainly left an impression on the team.
Yeah, that's a great story. I've been with startups and middle-sized companies, and I noticed also when growth happens, it's called growing pains, right? Because there's so many things that change in the environment, the structure, in the mechanics. Everything changes, and no matter how much you try to keep your hands on everything, but kind of things slip out, and to maintain that growth, it's difficult sometimes.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, businesses, I think, naturally hit certain inflection points, you know, where things start to break. And, you know, and candidly, we're at one now at FiUSA. You know, we're about to cross, you know, we're crossing $100 million in revenue this year, you know, up from 70 last year. And that is one of those inflection points. We blew through 100 employees and $100 million in revenue at a, you know, similar time. So, you know, from a employee headcount standpoint, things change at 100 employees. You know, from a revenue standpoint, things change at 100 million. And, you know, we're doing a lot of rebuilding some of our internal infrastructure to accommodate that with, you know, the goal of improve our employee experience, you know, remove some of the inefficiencies that have evolved in their day to day, and improve our client experience. You know, so everything we do, we're focused on improve our employee experience, improve our client experience. If we focus on those two things, we expect everything else will take care of themselves. So
I still want to touch a bit on safety, because that might be one of the main thing people ask about. So obviously there's one thing is the safety of the plane itself, the pilots, but obviously that could be an issue for any commercial flight as well. But what I'm wondering now is, what prevents someone from bringing weapons or guns on the plane? And of course you would ask, well, why would they do with it? Because everyone knows each other. But I'm just thinking of 9/11, of someone flying their plane into some building. What's the mechanism to prevent something like that?
Candidly, our clients, they disclose when they have them, but, you know, we take people on hunting trips and they take, you know, firearms with them on a, you know, on a pretty regular basis. So, it's disclosed to us in advance. We're clear on what the rules are. The rules are, you know, no different than commercial airlines, in which the way that the firearms have to be stored and secured. But there are processes for us to, you know, to manage that. You know, from a pilot training standpoint, and the maintenance of the aircraft, you know, everything is, you know, that we do with safety in mind. So, you know, the FAA has, there's a regulation, it's called FAA Part 135, which is effectively your air taxi license. So that is, to get that air taxi license from the FAA, you have to agree to a certain minimum pilot requirements and a more rigorous maintenance inspection. And, you know, what the FAA recommends for you to be able to do that, we consider to be just the baseline, but not acceptable. So everything we do is elevated from that. So we're, you know, and there are rating agencies from a safety perspective in our industry. One is called Argus, another is called Wyvern. We're Wyvern Wingman rated, which is their highest level of, you know, safety. And that's because our pilot qualifications are higher than the minimum standards required by the FAA. The way we manage our maintenance is a level above the minimum requirements by the FAA. So everything that we do with safety in mind. And really, we're not focused on the minimums. We're focused on, you know, what right looks like. And I think we do a really good job with that. Great job with that.
Now, tell us, why is this business important to you? You mentioned spending more time with family. Is that pretty much the primary reason you had to do this, to give this service to people?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mentioned I'm passionate about aviation, and I'm also passionate about growing businesses. You know, the fact that I'm able to do both and with family members as my partners is, I'm really enjoying the time, with what we're doing here. So, you know, I think it's, you know, we're all aviators and we're all business people, and, you know, that's a good combination. And I think is certainly contributing to our success.
Barry, what's your future plan with FlyUSA? Where do you see it in the future?
As part of our annual planning process, we have a long-term vision that we have, and, you know, we basically want to grow the business to, you know, 100 planes under management and, $500 million in revenue. And, you know, I think we're a third of the way there on the planes. and we're about a fifth of the way there on the revenue, and we expect that those two things will will collide sometime around 2031, 2032.
There's a lot of entrepreneurs in the Bay Area here in the Silicon Valley. What would be your advice? Sure. What would be your advice to them? You had two very successful companies, and what would your advice, especially since the huge percentage of companies now are focused on AI, you're offering something different. What would be your advice to them?
Yeah, I mean, on the AI front, I mean, our focus on AI is helping, give our employees superpowers. We're not looking to replace people with AI, but we are expecting our folks to use those tools to become more efficient and improve the way that we're serving our clients. We're in a business where it's high touch, right? And our clients don't want to talk to an auto attendant, and they don't want to be routed and put on hold through, an AI phone system. That is not the experience that they're looking for. I mentioned personalized earlier. They are expecting a person to answer the phone, and a person in the USA that speaks English is who they expect to answer the phone. And that is our commitment to them, not a call center in some other place where they're not going to understand the person on the other end. And again, we want it to be the person answering the phone should know who they are, and that is really the personalization of our particular product. As far as advice for entrepreneurs, I mean, it's just keep going. I mean, your job should be, I fancy myself, I'm the CEO, but I'm also the chief roadblock remover. I mean, problems happen every single day, and you just have to become efficient at removing the roadblocks, keep going. I think persistence and work ethic are, two things that combined, really contribute to the success of growing companies. So,
Barry, thank you so much for your time. Congratulations again, fastest growing aviation company for 2 years in a row and offering a great service to people. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it.
Thank you for watching another episode of Bay Area Innovators. If you enjoyed this episode and you know someone who should be on our show, please send us an email at sfbay@epochtimes.com. We would love to hear from you. Thank you, and see you next week.